Welcome back to the second portion of today's 6 CEU seminar regarding rethinking resistance and conflict in therapy. As we start in this second portion, one of the things I want to highlight is the differences in expectations between what our clients may think of what they're looking for in terms of mental health services versus what we believe we're offering them. This is an area where there can be resistance. Anytime there is a difference of opinion in terms of expectations or assumptions, that's where there could be conflict. So, for example, one of the areas we might want to look into is what kind of expectations are we putting out there in terms of the advertisements for the venue that we're working at, whether it be a community agency, a private practice, a hospital, for-profit or non-profit type of agency. What marketing are we putting out there? What phrases do we use? How do we summarize the type of atmosphere, the setting? So when we have this marketing and advertising out there, it gives a certain type of perception to our clients. And if they see that or hear that, or, for example, if there's opinions online in terms of people who have used services at where we worked before, either positive or negative opinions, those can impact things. What about the biographies about ourselves, our credentials, and our areas of expertise or scope of practice on the insurance panels? I know, for example, I'm on a number of insurance panels, and they'll ask me to fill out a checklist about scope of practice. Some let me check off several boxes, and some give a limited number about areas of expertise, areas of types of client referrals. So when a client is looking in a certain area for a practitioner, they might consider you a quote-unquote expert in that area. So if they see, oh, out of everybody who deals with anxiety, Michelle Sparks is listed in this area. Huh, she really must know something about anxiety. Or out of everybody who says they could work with this population, she's listed. That can give a certain perception to a client. Another thing that can influence expectations of mental health services is whether or not you have a website and what your website looks like. I find it interesting that oftentimes people assume, often mistakenly, that just because I have a website, that I'm some huge company with several employees and several practitioners. I've had people, when they come to my private practice, who are surprised. They say, wow, you have this extensive website. Oh, I didn't realize you only have a few practitioners working here. I thought you had several people working here. So sometimes people have this idea when you have a website that you must be something else out there and must be well off or must be pretty extensive in terms of the types of services that are offered. One of the things that we really want to be clear about in our written policies and procedures, as well as what we say and repeat throughout the sessions, is what clients think that they're giving consent for. That's why this whole ethical issue of informed consent is key, because a client might think he or she is agreeing to one thing versus we might think something else is what we're highlighting with them. We also want to look at what they think therapy is or is not. I've had clients who, for example, come in calling me doctor, and I'm definitely not a medical doctor. I may clarify that in terms of scope of practice, but there's some clients in different places that I've worked that assume that people that have degrees or work in the mental health field or have gone to graduate school must be quote-unquote doctors. I have people who think that our credentials mean a certain thing. And so we may want to clarify what your specific credentials mean. You know, there's this generic term out there that a lot of people use in terms of psychotherapist. And probably almost any of us could call ourselves, or what we do, psychotherapy. But in terms of our training, some people who are attending this seminar might be social workers, some might be counselors, some might be marriage and family therapists. We all have a really diverse background in terms of what types of environments we've worked in, and what the psychotherapy that we do, what that really involves. So clients come in with an assumption about our titles, about our credentials. That's why that disclosure statement on the wall is so important, for them to be able to see, oh, you went to this school, oh, you've done this so far. Or if they want you to ask questions about what our experience has entailed. Then even looking at things like the physical environment in terms of what they think that means or doesn't mean. That physical environment to some types of clients is very, very important. And finally, clients may have some opinions based on their perception of us, our office staff, the colleagues working in connection with us, or the types of clients that come in. I remember when I worked at a psych hospital that there was a young girl that came with her parents, came in for an assessment. And during that time, we had a direct from a medical hospital who was on a gurney, who was wheeled past her. And that alone gave her all kinds of assumptions and perceptions about what types of clients might be around her if she were to stay at that hospital. So again, there's all kind of unspoken thoughts that our clients have. And that's where resistance can come in. Because there could be that discrepancy between, ooh, I thought I'd be getting this, but this happened. Or, wow, I overheard that client say such and such in the lobby to the person they came in with. Or that person looked such and such compared to what I was used to. Or I thought this was a private practice and I thought the ambiance here would be this way versus that way. So again, there's ways that they think things are going to be. So it's important to consider, what are they giving informed consent for? So the extent and nature of services, even listing the pros and cons. Of course, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing if we didn't think there were benefits to it. But as with any technique, anytime we help clients learn new skills or challenge behaviors or deal with some of their presenting concerns, it's quite possible that there's many advantages, but they could also have people in their life who may not appreciate them learning new skills or changing or becoming a certain type of person. So it's important to make sure, if we're really getting true informed consent, that we not only discuss the pros, but the cons or the challenges of counseling in general, of electronic counseling, especially with the recent COVID influx. It's important to make sure people understand what are considerations with the use of technology. The limitations of things like electronic counseling, phone counseling, what type of techniques are used, and the fact that just because we say that a certain technique is recommended based on what our client's saying, it doesn't mean that we can really give it a prognosis specifically about the success or the failure of that. We really can't predictively say, oh, if this client uses this technique, he or she will end up such and such way. We also can't predict how much that client's going to apply the techniques that we teach him or her in session outside of sessions. So we have to be careful about that. Informed consent also includes giving information about the limitations of things, making sure that the language that we're using to get informed consent is clear, it's understandable, and it's not too technical to where our clients who maybe don't have that technical know-how in our field can really adequately understand it. We want to specify clearly who the provider is and make sure that we're checking in with them about if they do understand what they're consenting for. I actually will review with a client, and there's a statement I'll have on the bottom of my policies and procedures. I have read, understood, and agreed to the above. And so that means that I also give clients an opportunity to ask questions. And along those lines, I make accommodations if need be. If you have a client who maybe has struggles reading, whether they're illiterate, whether they're blind, whether some of the wording is difficult for them to understand, it may be useful to go over things and check and see how they perceive it. The other thing we want to make sure that we're going over with the client is what the role of a counselor is. Oftentimes our clients don't understand the differences between what a counselor, a mediator, a court guardian, or an expert witness might be. They're different. There may be some overlap in some of the roles, but they're not exactly the same. And so I always encourage people to have something like a form letter that you're able to give out to clients that summarizes that as a counselor, that what you do is diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders based on the DSM and what that entails. I also might include in there, I am not someone who makes opinions about custody. I am not an expert witness in court. I am not a forensic specialist. So they know what you are and what you're not. We also want to be clear about the expectations of both the therapist and client behaviors. For example, many people in their policies and procedures will put something like therapy is a voluntary process, that it's a walking alongside in a voluntary therapeutic partnership or alliance. So the informed consent is an important piece. Another area where we really want to be aware of potential resistance is the area of diagnosis. This kind of boils down to, why do we ask the questions we do? And what a diagnosis means. For example, in some communities, even going to a mental health professional, regardless of what happens there, has a taboo. So assessment and diagnosis really can mean a lot of different things for different people. For some people, it's freeing to connect with a therapist who understands, who knows me, who can maybe, quote, get my employer or the other people in my family or in my life to really understand what's going on with me. For others, it's scary because the idea of having a label or diagnosis carries a stigma with it. The whole point of the concerns about assessment and diagnosis boils down to the issue of who knows what. And this also deals with things like informed consent and releases of consent. We want to make sure that we're not acting inappropriately as moral agents just because we feel something about a client, just because we think that a client might be such and such diagnosis, or we get an impression. We need to make sure that our diagnosis and our treatment planning is based on concrete, observable behaviors and actual, real, efficacious types of treatment. We need to make sure that it's compared to the norms of what research in the field would show, and that we're respectful of clients' perspectives and worldviews. We also have that informed consent, and that there is a specific contract or agreement about the nature of the therapeutic relationship. I know these may sound like simple foundational things, but really any one of these pieces can become a source of conflict if we're not careful about being clear and upfront and saying things in a way that is meaningful for the client and that fosters a healthy therapeutic alliance. Another area that we want to consider, just on a practical side in terms of rethinking resistance and conflict in therapy, is the area of treatment planning. We need to look at what goals the client will buy into. I always talk about how even with involuntary clients, clients that are maybe on a pink slip, that are mandated to treatment because they've expressed issues of harm to self or others, or maybe they're court ordered for various reasons, it's still important to look at what is the smallest goal that they can agree to, even if it's something like getting the court off their back, or complying with probation, or returning to work. Looking at what are the client's desires? What does the client perceive to have worked so far or not worked so far? Even in other rounds of therapy, even prior to what we're doing with them. And how involved they want to get or they don't want to get. That really makes a difference in terms of if they think that the therapist is supposed to be, quote, an expert that's imposing something on me or motivating me or getting me to be something versus how much they want to be involved in the therapeutic process. Those assumptions can really make a big difference in how we interact and whether or not there's resistance and conflict. Another area of treatment planning that's important to consider is how the goals are measured and whether we have operational definitions of goals, how achievable the goals are, and the competing demands that are all vying for attention. What the therapist wants for the client, when we see the presenting concern, what we think might be a good treatment goal versus what the client's hoping for. And then what if you have other layers, like you have an agency or an employer that are referring the client? What if there's a school? What if there's family or friends who also have different ideas? So I've cited an article by Duff and Betty who talk about what our clients' perceptions of what they think predicts therapeutic alliance. And I think this is important because a lot of times we hear what the research says or what our assumptions as a therapist would be. But there are some things that seem to jump out in the literature in terms of what the clients prefer and helps them feel like they really do have a genuine therapeutic partnership. And why this is so important is because a good therapeutic alliance really just flies in the face of resistance. It's one of the best ways to decrease resistance. So clients say one of the things they find helpful is someone, a therapist, who asks them questions with a genuine concern and sincerity, that someone who identified and reflected back their feelings really tried to hear their narrative, someone who validated their experience, who had congruent verbals and nonverbals, things like made eye contact with them, was honest, sat still, faced them, and allowed them to foster and decide some of the course of action of the therapy. They also found that sometimes self-disclosure of the therapist was particularly helpful to them when the therapist told them about similar experiences he or she had. And again, when it was for the benefit of the client, not just the therapist venting or detracting from the therapeutic time. Clients liked when there was a sense of them being allowed to determine the course of therapy. If there were topics that were all occurring at once and the therapist were to, for example, ask, oh, tell me out of these three things I hear you saying, are any of these topics more important that you'd like to focus on in this session? Things like that were very meaningful to them. The other thing that clients really liked is when the therapist kept as much as possible the administrative side of things out of the sessions. So while we have the unnecessary evils of, or the necessary evils of things like billing and paying and note taking and those kind of things, we also want to be careful about how we handle those. One of the topics that can make a difference in things for clients as well is this topic of mattering. We all have an internal need to feel significant. There's a sense of general mattering. If I wasn't here, if I wasn't in the world, would it make a difference? Would anybody care? And then there's that sense of interpersonal mattering. Why do I exist? What difference do I make to others? Does anyone even notice me or care? Are my interactions with others different because of me? Do I have the social supports I desire? Counselors can have a very significant role in shaping mattering. Keep in mind, it's one thing for us to say to a client, you're important, you're needed, you're valued, but it's a whole other thing for our behavior to show them this, that our nonverbals are really attending, that we're listening to the narrative, that we're not distracted by other things. As I spoke a little bit ago, I mentioned about what clients said helped foster the therapeutic alliance. And one of the things that they mentioned was reasonable, healthy self-disclosure. So how do we choose disclosure wisely? So modeling freedom for clients that they can disclose, that they can be vulnerable, that it's not an awful thing to share. Also, another reason to disclose is it can reduce the client's sense of being alone in his or her problem. Sometimes that client may feel like, I'm the only one going through this. And a disclosure can help sometimes the client to realize that it's a problem that's common to humanity or that other people are facing similar challenges. It increases a sense of realness in the counselor, that the counselor's not just this super expert who's beyond having any concerns in his or her life. Sidney Girard talks about something called the dyadic effect. What this means is disclosure begets disclosure. People are more likely to be open with interviewers who themselves are open than people who express little or nothing of themselves. So keep in mind that if our disclosure is for proper reasons, it can actually open the client more up to a healthy therapeutic alliance. Why would we not want to disclose then? Well, there are some reasons against disclosure as well that need to be considered. And they can affect the resistance level. If our disclosure really is shifting the focus off the client and what's maybe needed and most advantage at a given time, then that can be harmful. If it's using up valuable counseling time that could be better used in terms of focusing on clients' needs, or if it's causing role confusion, those are things that we need to watch out for. Because those can result in a challenging resistance being manifest. What type of things did clients say was helpful disclosure? Well, they said things that helped them feel accepted and encouraged. That goes back to that mattering that we just spoke about. Things that gave them attention. Things that reinforce that they're valued. Sometimes just even the listening and being present, maybe not even the words we say, but sometimes just the attending and being free from distraction is helpful. The use of open and closed questions and knowing when to do what. The reflection of the content of sessions. Disclosure or reflection of feelings. And even confrontation, clients said, could be helpful. The key is developing an understanding of what disclosure means to a given client and really matching that. Clients actually had a way they made a judgment about what disclosures were helpful. The four things they highlighted were helpful disclosures helped build my confidence, is one thing clients said. They also mentioned it helped me share more. Third, I felt relieved afterward. So another reason for disclosure. And finally, they said I had more respect for the therapist or the clinical relationship afterwards. So there are things we want to consider in terms of disclosure. Have I paused to evaluate the potential disclosure beforehand? Why am I disclosing? How will this disclosure help the client's goals in counseling? Are there any conditions which necessitate this disclosure? If so, what? Are there any other ways of approaching the client's issue that may be as effective as disclosure? Is there any potential harm or danger if this is disclosed to the client? Does the client have the ego strength for this disclosure? How will this disclosure blur professional boundaries? Now that's a big concern. So that would be something we want to pay attention to. Will the client look at me differently after I disclose that? Sometimes self-disclosures can help, but sometimes the client can look at us as a bit less professional. How will the disclosure help the client emotionally? Will it get them closer to instilling more hope, moving forward towards their goals, and feeling less alone? On the other hand, could this disclosure make my client feel more demoralized? Will this disclosure help in terms of like cognitive debating skills, like in CBT? Will it help them with reality check? So if you're not sure, one of the things you could try and do is test out on a lower level disclosure, like a topic the client might wonder about, and then move to a deeper disclosure. Let's look at a few other areas in terms of rethinking resistance and conflict in therapy. One that's vitally important is cultural competency. If you've listened to any of my seminars regarding cultural competency, in a very simplistic level, I mentioned that culture is really the way a group of people do something. It doesn't matter if it's their look, the music they listen to, the environment they live in, their worldview on any topic. It's a way of approaching life. Culture is so infused into the working alliance. So culture must be infused into all we do. The worldview, orientation, race, ethnicity, identity factors, abilities, religion, socioeconomic status, language, music, hobbies, traditions, or beliefs can all be part of culture. So there's three areas of competency we want to make sure we're highlighting to really be most effective with clients. First is that of self, secondly, cultural awareness overall, and third, being culturally sensitive within the working alliance. So it's so important for us, even if you are independently licensed, or even if you're a supervising professional, to make sure that you have other people that keep you in check. We're not always self-aware as much as we'd like to be. So that's where that other person, if we're meeting with him or her for supervision, can help address our personal assumptions, values, and potential biases. We can also look at our overall cultural awareness of the others. We may or may not understand or know what their worldview is. And then the working alliance in general. Are we demonstrating overall respect for the totality of who this person is? Are we showing that in terms of goal formation and collaboration? Shame is a huge issue in the literature. In the past, you might have listened to my seminar regarding shame. And I always talk about shame as kind of being a often universal thread throughout many of the mental health disorders. Shame essentially is the inability to separate behavior from personhood. So it's one thing when we make a mistake or have a regret in life and we wish we would have done things differently to say, oh, next time I'm going to try this other thing. But it's a whole other thing to say, oh, I'm a flawed person, to have a subjective emotion that's narrowly focused, where there's a loss of context, where there's almost like this emotional paralysis or feeling immobilized, a sense of desperation that my identity is just flawed. There's a belief that I'm inherently flawed and imperfect. I'm inadequate. It's impossible for someone to love me as defective as I am. That I'm less than I should be. And if I don't measure up, then others must also think that I'm less than. Shame is very, very self-conscious. It's negative, global, and has beliefs about the environment being stable and controllable, as opposed to things being somewhat unstable and changeable, that eventually over time things do change. There's a sense with shame, a fear of disrepute, keeping things secret. Shame necessitates a cover-up. There's this desire to hide because of fear of people's opinion. There's a sense of unstable trust and security. There's a sense of disappointment in oneself and even really being a false self, not really even knowing at extreme ends of who I am. Shame-based relationships have things in common, like a sense of control or desire for control, and this chaos, this confusion about how did I even get here? And you'll hear a lot of talk about hopeless and helpless feelings. You might see some nonverbals of this sense of just giving up, this lack of resolution, possible resentment. Again, not wanting to change problem behaviors, but just resentment over who I am as a person. There's a sense of ambiguity and not being clear about what the rules and expectations are. There's unspoken guidelines, and there may be game playing or passive underlying threats or threads that need to be figured out. So shame is a really big issue and many, many mental health concerns that our clients may come to us about. I think if we can do shame-informed therapy, it goes such a long way. I would say one of the most helpful areas that many of my clients have said that it makes a difference to them is when I help identify some of these core shame-based messages. And oftentimes they're really long-standing. They can be things from their family of origin. They could be things that are rather resistant. Things that the literature would call schemas, beliefs, just threads, repetitive ways of approaching things. There's some behaviors that when you see might be a cue to you that there's shame going on. Maybe there's difficulty falling and staying asleep, or someone sleeping too much, trying to avoid. There may be controlled eating, like eating disorders. Things like distrust, suspicion, withdrawal, or poor impulse control. There could be extreme legalistic behaviors. There could be physical, sexual, or emotional abuses. Hoarding, extreme thriftiness, or overspending. There could be behaviors like affairs, pornography, compulsive masturbation, or sexual disorders. There can be mood disorders, things like depression, anxiety, and just dysregulation in general. And you may see this pushing or pulling away interpersonally. So a lot of the common things that we see in therapy can be, to some degree, linked to shame. Keep in mind, if someone feels a sense of shame, they feel like they're not sure they matter, or that they equate their behavior with their personhood, there could be a sense of defensiveness. So what can come across as unhealthy resistance might just be that sense of shame inside of them. One of the things we ultimately want to cultivate with clients, which can really help move beyond resistance and conflict, is the idea of resiliency. We want to feel with a client and communicate that to the other. So essentially the very definition of empathy. We want to normalize human experience and come across as non-judgmental. We can help clients actually move past shame by helping recognize and understand their triggers to shame, having high levels of critical awareness about shame triggers, being willing to reach out to others, and one of the biggest things, which I know author and social worker Brené Brown highlights regarding shame, is that shame can be healed when we put past hurt and pains into words. Part of what keeps shame going is when we hide it. But when we put it into words, we can actually do something about it. That can be the catalyst to move forward. So we can teach clients to process emotions in healthy ways by intentionally naming and realistically processing emotions, encouraging them to try out alternative realities, that maybe they've tried certain things and they've worked to some degree, but there's nothing wrong. Like I always tell clients, things are modifiable. We can try a different approach. We can try a different frequency or a different place or way that we try these different things. Another way of processing in the healthier way is to remind themselves, "Ah, I've been here before. I know this hasn't led to a good place. Maybe I need to stop." So thought stopping. And learning to tolerate the reality of human suffering and needs in realistic ways. One thing I don't want to gloss over that I think is important, you know, we talked a lot about client stuff with regards to resistance and conflict in therapy. But one area I think we need to touch on today is the idea of the therapist's own stuff. How we react to the compilation of years of difficult cases, of stresses in the environments we work on, and just the compassion fatigue of the nature of what we do makes a difference. I've talked in past seminars about what's called the interpersonal cycle of burnout. It always starts with those cognitive thoughts of the dissonance between this is where I thought I'd be in the field, this is what I thought this setting would offer me, versus what's happening. There's comparison. It could be, gosh, they don't pay me enough here, even though I'm doing all this productivity, even though I'm making a difference. I just feel like it's not even worth the amount of money anymore. Or it could be a sense of injustice. Look what I'm all doing here, and I don't feel like I'm even getting any rewards for it. Then over time, you might notice that you tend to talk more in a negative light with your colleagues. Just the sense of things not having equity, feeling like the contributions you're giving for the benefits are just not worth it. And you might also notice that there seems to almost be a sense of negative norms in the work setting, to where it's like, oh, this isn't really being dealt with. It's almost like just swept under the rug. Everybody seems to have this sense that this is how this work setting is, but this feeling like no one's really solving it. And what seems to cap off this interpersonal cycle of burnout is the idea that it feels like there's not very many positive alternatives. Really, you start to hear yourself, or if it's a colleague that has this talking about just being trapped, discrepancies between the way things should be and actualities. Several factors can actually contribute to our dissatisfaction in the field. So these are things we need to look at, because if we're feeling dissatisfied, our clients can be pretty perceptive. And a lot of times they can pick up on some of that. We need to be aware of that. And if need be, it's important to either have friends in the field to talk to, or supervisors, or possibly even get your own psychotherapy. Things that could be overwhelming for us are the client loads. Fact of the matter is, for most of us, the helping fields are not something where we're going to get rich. We're doing this because we want to make a difference in someone's life. But there's productivity, but there's a certain amount of workload and client load that we have to carry to make ends meet. And as much as we want to do this to help others, a lot of times there's hoops we have to jump through. There's notes. There's ways of formatting things to get paid by insurance companies. There's procedures of the type of agency that we work at. There's time frame for doing things that can be a pressure. Sad thing, you know, sometimes we have this idea, whether it's from TV, you know, have you ever noticed on these TV shows, they always show these psychotherapists with really plush offices and money and nice cars. And I'm thinking, gosh, I don't know how many of us can really relate to that. But look at the role models or the examples out there. And I'm thinking, no wonder our clients think we have the good life, because that's what TV shows. And it's very far from the truth of the reality most of us live in. We also may have role models that we've witnessed, like some of our professors in grad school. I remember my first grad class seeing this 29-year-old professor who everybody just admired. She was pretty. She was intelligent. She had her private practice. She was a mom. She was a professor. She knew her stuff. She impacted clients' lives. And we were just kind of in awe of her, thinking, how in the world does she do all this stuff? Look at this. You know, if she can do it, maybe we can do it. And then there comes this sense of, yeah, but, you know, she's years ahead of us. She's had a little bit of practice. She has a support system. And, you know, so some of us would be hard on ourselves thinking we should, quote unquote, be able to do that off the bat. So there's a lot of factors that can contribute to therapist dissatisfaction. And a lot of it boils down to the many facets of the work we do. Almost everybody experiences burnout at some point in our field. And, I want you to keep that in mind, because I've had a number of people who will be really self-critical about the fact that they're going through any level of burnout. And they may think that it means that they're just not cut out for the field. That's not necessarily true. The research would suggest that over the lifespan of the work we do as therapists, that there seems to almost be this 10-year cycle, that within every 10 years or less, that there's almost like a sense that we need to hit a reset button. Maybe work in a different setting. Maybe work with some different populations. Or just things in a different way because of the burnout. What's interesting to me is that there are some pretty high rates of statistics in terms of people having depression in our field, depending on whether you're looking at a given time or over the life course of a person. We can see 60 to 90% of mental health professionals at a given point in time, or especially over the course of their lifespan, having some type of depression. So it boils down to this idea, is the pay really worth the emotional cost? Where do I stand on the mission of this organization I'm working for? Do I really buy into this? A lot of times the agencies we work for have these nice little mission statements, and they always sound good, but then so often I will hear colleagues say, yeah, that's what they say. Yeah, that's what the mission is. But shoot, if people knew behind the scenes some of the junk going on. And so that breeds dissatisfaction and burnout. That sense of, are we saying this, but do I really believe we're doing this? Then that overwhelming sense of, what do I do with all these administrative tasks and other associated tasks versus why I even got into the field to begin with? Burnout also can be fostered when we feel like there's just not a good work-life balance, where there is almost no personal life left. If the job appears to be affecting our home or other aspects of life. So I made a list in terms of comparing and contrasting healthy and unhealthy types of beliefs or dynamics that the literature would suggest lead to burnout or prevent burnout. If we work somewhere where it appears that the employees have a strong commitment, where we see longevity, where we see loyalty to the company, you tend to see less burnout. And that's always interesting to watch. Now, when you see certain settings, for example, usually community mental health or certain settings where there's a weak commitment of counselors, meaning there's a lot of turnaround, that staff don't tend to stay very long, that can be a red flag. That can be something to say, it may be challenging to avoid burnout. One of the things that's very healthy is when you see mental health agencies where co-worker relationships and supervision also are really supported, because it creates a balance. It helps us not feel alone. It also helps us learn skills and ways of approaching difficult cases versus unhealthy settings where there's minimal opportunities for genuine relationship and connection with colleagues, where there's low collegial support, and where expectations are ambiguous. The more we understand what our role is, just like we talked about the importance of informed consent for a client, it's important for us to know what our job and role expectations are, not just in a general sense, but in a very specific application. How does this pan out? It's one thing to have a canned job description, but it's a whole nother thing to be like, oh, when it comes down to it, how do we deal with such and such issues? What are the expectations? So the more specific and concrete those are, the more that tends to prevent burnout versus ambiguous or changing expectations, which seem to foster burnout. While we want support as we're learning and managing stresses in our jobs, there's also something to be said for a setting that allows freedom for some autonomy, that allows for new ideas and creativity. That can go a long way. So the structure is important to lay a foundation, but how we get to the outcome when there's flexibility can make a big difference. One of the things that is really important in terms of motivating those of us in the mental health field is to feel like we're in a setting where there is a sense of purpose and fulfillment. Sometimes to that end, it's good for us to share our success stories. It's not that we've necessarily not had challenging clients, but maybe there's a way in spite of the challenging clients that we learned to get through, to see the rewards. It's also helpful to have a sense of a solid clinical identity, realistic goals, and know that sometimes setbacks are just a part of the job. One of the unhealthy approaches, on the other hand, is when people have this idea that clients are all supposed to like you, that you're the expert, you're responsible for the change, again, rather than that this is a therapeutic partnership. One of the things that we see that also can really weigh into this issue of resistance and conflict in therapy is sometimes there's differences between client goals and therapist goals. Just because we may think something's best for the client doesn't mean there's a true readiness on the part of the client to explore that. if you remember the stages of change kind of stuff that you probably learned in grad school, keep in mind that just because a client's coming to us doesn't mean they're even ready for therapy. They may not have even formally decided that they really want to change things in their life, because that requires things to turn upside down, that requires possible new skill development, that requires effort, that requires time. So we have to look at the client versus the therapist's goals. One of the things that can reduce resistance is being more specific about what we're looking for. Specific goals are easier to achieve. Specific, measurable, achievable. Are there things that the client can do? Maybe they haven't done them to the frequency that would be desired to this point. Or are there things we can be doing, just need to be more frequent or intensive about it? Also, realistic goals are broken down into manageable parts. They're concrete, they're behavioral, they're evidence-based, and they're individualized or tailored to each specific client. We also have to make sure we realize that while we're specific with these goals, that things aren't perfectly linear, that there needs to be some resilience and some flexibility and an ability to modify things as need be. We're not looking at absolutes about the rightness or wrongness of decisions, but we're looking at trying to be aware of the timing of decisions and just being flexible and allowing for correction and modification. So taking goals like to improve a client's sense of confidence and being more specific. What would be happening, for example, if a client was more confident? What would they be doing? So being very specific about goals. So we look at addressing the cognitive expectations about ourselves, about the setting we're in, about clients. We look at the time spent in the field, and maybe if it's time we need to be ready for a break. We look at the types of cases we're dealing with, and issues like how controllable something is, the caseload versus the types of clients, and the balance. Just like in cognitive behavioral therapy, there's types of beliefs that can be toxic. Things like shoulds, ought to, if only, then comments, absolute thoughts. We also want to evaluate these types of things within ourselves. These are the irrational beliefs of burnout-prone therapists. Things like, I should always work at my peak level of enthusiasm and competence. I should be able to cope with any emergencies. I should be able to help any client. So I should always be available and ready. I should be able to deal with things. I should be on call. Clients' needs come before my needs. It's selfish to put my needs first. I can't do self-care. I can't do this on my own. I have to help fix and control clients. So these are things that we want to be aware of. We want to not only use these cognitive debating strategies with our clients, but also with ourselves. Things like, is this a fact or is it just an opinion? Is there any other way of looking at this? According to who? Why is what that person says the absolute truth? Is this belief life-giving or death-producing? If this belief is not helpful to me, how can I continue telling myself this? Is there any other way of looking at this? Is what I'm thinking an absolute fact or just a very strong feeling or opinion? Is this just an automatic, habitual way I tend to look at things when they become overwhelming? Is there any evidence to suggest that this way of thinking is not entirely true? Am I jumping to conclusions that aren't justified by the evidence? Am I focusing on my weakness and not considering my strengths? What advice would I give to someone else in this situation? What evidence might someone else point out to show me that my thoughts are not entirely true? What have I learned from past experiences that could help me? How have I managed in the past? I love that question because one of the things I think that really makes a difference and can really reduce resistance and conflict is brief solution-focused therapy. It's strengths-based. I love that wording, how have I managed? Because it brings an assumption to the client, yes, I have managed. Another consideration is this situation really as important as it seems now? Might I see this situation differently in a few months or years? Am I blaming myself or someone else for something I really can't control? So these cognitive debating strategies, again, are not just skills that we want to share with our clients, but things that can benefit us as well. There are struggles that we see that counselors have. On the one hand, we feel like we wouldn't be in the field that we are if we didn't believe that doing the therapy that we do is beneficial. But on the other hand, the literature does show that counselors have struggles admitting that we have problems. We have struggles admitting that we need outside help. And that as much as we tell clients and other people in public that having counseling is beneficial, sometimes we're resistant to having that outside help. We kind of feel, especially if we're of more of a cognitive behavioral orientation, that we should just be able to snap into a different way of thinking or believing and just challenge ourselves and things should poof be better. Another area that we can look at in terms of managing our own stress level is the idea of caseload versus workload. Caseload has to do with which types of clients we're seeing. Are we seeing many mandatory clients? Are we seeing clients that maybe aren't the greatest fit with us? You know, we all have types of clients that drain us more than others. I remember talking with my colleagues, and for me, I don't get drained by grief counseling cases, but I know some of them did. But for me, there's other types of cases that I just don't care for as much. So looking at what is the caseload, how much control do I have over that, depending on the setting I work in? I mean, especially if you work in community mental health and there's all kinds of walk-ins and they're like, okay, you're up next. You get to talk with this one. And maybe it's not the type of client that is your cup of tea or is your strength. That can make a big difference. Versus workload is the actual amount of time spent in client contact and work-related functions. So it's not just, our stress level is not just how many hours am I spending on the job. It's what's happening in the time I'm there. You could be there 5 or 10 hours, and those hours just drag on because you're seeing so many depressed clients in a row, or you struggle to deal with personality disorders, or substance abusers who relapse or pushing your buttons. The keys with this idea of caseload and workload is making sure that we reach out, that we make use of support systems, that we remind ourselves that it's not a weakness to have or desire support systems, that it doesn't make us less effective. It just makes us just as human as the next person. Now, one of the topics that I highlight both with clients as well as I think with all of us mental health professionals is this concept of wellness. One of the keys that I think is really important for us to remember that wellness is both an outcome and a process. It's not that you do A, B, and C, step 1, 2, 3, and then I've achieved wellness. there may be certain goals that we want to target. There may be some concrete behavioral steps, like we said earlier, about the importance of specific goals being more achievable. But on the other hand, we're talking about allowing ourselves or allowing the client to go through a process. That's where resilience really comes in. And so there's several dimensions, and we can't minimize these. As simple as they sound, in reality, they can be challenging to do. So the first dimension is the physical. Are we really sleeping when we need to sleep? What about our eating habits? Do we eat healthy? Are we alert? Are we aware and attentive to clients? What about our ability to physically accomplish the tasks of counseling? Do we have a regular schedule of meals? Are we making sure we have sufficient liquids? What about making sure we're careful about how much sugar we're eating because of the sugar highs and sugar lows? Those can impact our work significantly. Do we keep up with our routine medical exams? Is the environment welcoming, not just for the client, but for us, if we're going to have to do these related tasks that aren't always so thrilling and uplifting, like the paperwork or the administrative stuff? Do we have an environment that is conducive? Do we allow ourselves to have breaks where we're not focusing on counseling-related things, but we're doing something else? So we talked about the physical, but the emotional aspects are just as important. So on the one hand, do we have the skills to do the job that we're supposed to be doing to help clients identify their concerns and process their feelings and issues? Are we able to balance insight, awareness, and action? Do we allow emotionally for ourselves to have balance between the social time and our time to ourselves? Do we have adequate professional training and competency? Again, addressing things like caseload. Do we allow ourselves vacations or breaks? What do we do to remind ourselves of the things that we've done well? I think a lot of times we harp on the challenging cases or the frustrations, but is there a way, you know, without the identifying information and with protecting the confidentiality, that we could have almost like a little notebook of success stories or reminders to celebrate from a strengths-based perspective what's gone well? Revisit successful client files. Reevaluate personal growth. Have accountability with clients. That doesn't just help us when we have difficulties, but it also helps normalize some of the frustrations and concerns we're going through, that we're not the only one. Another thing towards this emotional health is making sure we're involved in our interests or projects outside ourselves and limit relationships that appear to be one way and not genuinely giving towards us. I always tell clients, self-care is not selfish, but it's important for us to remind ourselves of that. If we need to, we need to look at any areas where we might have unresolved issues, where we might need client or might need counseling. Make sure we have a network of supervising counselors to speak with. Make sure we have healthy lifestyle behaviors. Allow for there to be space away from the clinical setting. Take time off when need be. Make sure our contracts are clear in terms of our job. Charging an appropriate fee. Keeping our professional development up to date. And making sure we have a plan for letting go of stress at the end of the day. One of the goals in the literature that talks about wellness is the concept of self-direction and self-efficacy. We can achieve that towards things like mindfulness, just learning how to be in the here and now without feeling like we constantly have to be doing and achieving and mastering something. We to that end can have acceptance of our whole self, both our shortcomings and strengths, and develop realistic beliefs, have emotional awareness and regulation, have creative problem solving and goal setting. Leisure is huge. It's so important to balance work and other time, relaxation. I think sometimes we harp on wanting to be ultra productive. But one of the things I highlight both with clients and with colleagues is the importance of learning to be, not just do. Having a distraction away from unpleasant life events. Leisure contributes greatly to mood enhancement and generating optimism about the future. Remember, in some of my seminars, I talk about the narrative approach of therapy. And if we're going to look at how do I reconstruct problematic narratives, one way of doing that is leisure, is interrupting the problem-based narrative with some positive or neutral types of issues. We also can't minimize the importance of things like social supports, having relational connection with others. It's important to remind yourself that there's nothing wrong with asking for help when needed. Having connections in our personal life with family and friends, with colleagues. These social supports can help facilitate compassion, help us normalize feelings, reduce self-blame. You know, we talked earlier about shame being an element that many of our clients experience. But a lot of times, you know, is that an issue possibly that us as mental health professionals wrestle with? Do we need to look at reducing self-blame and shame and facilitating realistic self-acceptance? Toward that end, another area of wellness is the concept of love. This is defined as building trust in our ability to give and receive from others. Having some stability in close relationships. This goes back to the concept of mattering. Knowing someone really cares for you. We want to focus on resiliency. Resiliency essentially is defined as having adaptation under adversity. It's the ability to recover from psychological harm. That we're no longer defined by just negative or problematic experiences, but we can jump and bounce back, that we can learn things and even possibly thrive. Resiliency is acceptance of the totality of our reality surrounding something. We can still have our strongly held values. We can have a balanced sense of optimism without distortion. We can look at hope for the future and cognitive flexibility. There's balance between concealing and expressing emotions. The literature talks about narratives of resilience, learning to reconstruct the story as one which is able to be modified, promoting an internal locus of control and manageable goals, seeing things work out, envisioning stress and trauma being disrupted, and creating a long-term vision. And this also works towards helping our clients rethink resistance and conflict. With the narrative therapy, if it's truly a restorative narrative, how would they imagine if things were different? Especially with younger kids, I'll use the idea of if you had 3 wishes, what would be different? What would you hope for? As counselors, one of the things in the literature they talk about in terms of facilitating resilience is the concept of counselor stamina. Stamina is defined as a strength to withstand and hold up under pressure. There's 7 principles that are important to facilitating counselor stamina. One of the things we can do that can really help us to not be as defensive and carry too much stress that can influence a therapeutic relationship is to be selective or intentional about how we spend our time, what tasks we're doing, what populations we're working with, how many cases or what those look like, and just having reasonable goals and objectives. We can look at also temporal selectivity in terms of our time balance. Do I see clients back to back? Is there spacing in between to go to the restroom or take a break or refocus? How do I juggle the tasks? What about accountability, which involves, again, that interpersonal relationship or partnership with credible colleagues? Things like establishing a standard of care, making sure I'm following ethical principles and looking at what reasonable practices. Counselor stamina also involves conserving and budgeting of the resources. What is involved in my role at my job? What choices do I have and how I work towards that? And then counselor stamina also involves the idea of how do I get to a good outcome? This desire for ongoing learning, this fascination with the narrative of working with people, which is a lot of the reason why we went into this field in the first place and what their journey in life is. The literature calls this inquisitiveness or mutual puzzling, the idea of the therapist and the client together going through this therapeutic narrative. A sixth area of counselor stamina is that of negotiation. This means having that flexibility. Diagnosis, treatment, goals, interactions in a flexible way. So challenging that old mindset of, oh, we're just the expert. A seventh aspect of counselor stamina is that of acknowledgement of agency, focusing on personally meaningful goals. I encourage you, as we talk about wellness and planning for wellness as both an ongoing process and an outcome, to do this little exercise that I have in the PowerPoints. I've listed a number of words, and you could also do something like this with a client. Words like health, healing, replenishing or renewal, escape, coping, fulfillment and satisfaction, and looking at concrete behavioral ways I define those. What does health look like for me? I might define that one way, whereas another friend or colleague might define it another way. And I think one of the best ways we can wrap up today is learning to create a self-pledge, almost like a vow to yourself. I would write this out. Maybe give a copy of it to a colleague who could hold you accountable. Maybe even keep one in your office. Put one at home. What would it look like to have a balance of time, to realistically respond to client demands, to set boundaries professionally and personally, to reassess and modify goals? Just like I tell clients, everything's modifiable. We can recall that for ourselves, to do one thing for ourselves. We don't have to do everything all the time right across the situation, but to just allow for self-care in small doses, not to wait till the someday when everything's caught up, not to wait till the someday when clients are all at the best place. And then finally, to allow leisure every day in small doses.